The decapitated head of a farmer's wife, dug up by feral dogs from her shallow grave outside Skibbereen in January 1847, marked a turning point in Ireland's descent into horror. By then, the starving were scaling treacherous cliffs for seagull eggs. Workhouses had become death chambers, with thousands perishing weekly. And desperate emigrants were abandoning family bonds in their frantic escape from a dying land. Between 1845 and 1855, Ireland's population of 8.2 million would shrink by a third, 1.1 million dead from starvation and disease, another 2 million fled overseas. Though smaller in absolute numbers than later Chinese or Soviet famines, the proportional devastation was unparalleled in modern European history. The catastrophe's timing couldn't have been worse, striking when two-thirds of Ireland depended solely on the potato, before infrastructure existed to manage such disaster. What transformed a crop failure into one of history's most haunting tragedies, however, was British policy that prioritized agricultural modernization and character improvement over saving lives. As officials required small farmers to surrender their plots to qualify for relief while transferring costs to Ireland itself, a humanitarian crisis became a national apocalypse, one whose echoes still reverberate in Irish memory nearly two centuries later. In September 1845, an unmistakably English horseman with flaming red hair surveyed Donegal's empty landscape. He'd passed shoeless women loading turf onto donkeys and ancient castle ruins before entering a realm of savage rock and mountains where only his horse's hooves broke the silence. This was Thomas Campbell Foster, sent by the Times to investigate the mischief which prevails in Ireland, a land that occupied the Western mind as places like Haiti or Somalia do today. Ireland's desperate poverty stemmed from rapid population growth and economic collapse. Between 1745 and 1845, the population exploded from 2.5 million to 8.2 million, while the post-Napoleonic economic contraction and British tariff removals devastated Irish industries. A Drogheda weaver who earned 14.21 shillings weekly in 1800 earned just 4 to 8 shillings a generation later. The industrial collapse pushed people onto already crowded land, creating intense competition and subdivision. By 1841, 45% of Irish farms were under 5 acres, forcing peasants to rely exclusively on potatoes. A single acre produced up to 6 tons, enough to feed a family of 6 for a year. Ironically, despite their poverty, the Irish peasantry appeared remarkably robust. Adam Smith noted that London's strongest men and most beautiful women came from Ireland's lowest rank who ate potatoes. The average Irishman was taller and stronger than his English counterpart. Yet this reliance on potatoes created extreme vulnerability. In the 1830s, scarcely a year passed without regional crop failures somewhere in Ireland. Beyond poverty, sectarian violence troubled British officials. Secret societies like the Molly Maguires defended poor farmers through intimidation and violence, while the bitter divide between the Catholic majority and Protestant Anglo-Irish ruling class made controlling violence difficult. This division traced back to the plantation period when Edmund Spencer, a young civil servant serving under Lord Grey, advocated reconquest and elimination of Celtic culture. His vision would later materialize through rebellions, Cromwell's devastating campaign, and the establishment of the Protestant ascendancy, transforming Ireland from 2% British in 1600 to 27% by 1700, with British settlers controlling 95% of land by 1750. By the 1840s, British officials had embraced commercial farming as a solution to Irish poverty and violence. They believed it would reduce population growth, as wage-earning laborers would need to purchase food rather than subsist on potatoes, while undermining Daniel O'Connell's movement against the Anglo-Irish Union. The transition would require disposing of hundreds of thousands of small farms, something that could best be accomplished during a crisis that destabilized the established order. As the summer of 1845 brought unseasonably cool, wet weather across Western Europe, a mysterious potato blight began devastating crops. Starting in Flanders in June, where farmers discovered white spots on potato leaves that quickly turned brown, the disease spread rapidly across the continent. By mid-August, the blight had crossed the channel to England, first appearing on the Isle of Wight before spreading to the mainland. The Gardener's Chronicle warned of a blight of unusual character with no known cure. By September, major newspapers were reporting extensively on the crisis, with Belgium losing 87% of its potato crop, Holland 70%, and France and Germany 20%. As the scientific community fractured into three camps over the blight's cause, politics and personality overshadowed science. The meteorologists blamed the wet, cold summer. The degenerists attributed it to biological corruption from repeated cultivation, while the fungalists correctly identified a fungus as the culprit, though their theory wouldn't be validated for 16 years. Only years later would Anton de Bary establish that Phytophthora infestans, a plant-destroying fungus, was the true cause. The summer of 1845 in Ireland began with extraordinary heat and dryness before shifting to unseasonable coolness and rain by July. While blight reports from England occasionally caused concern, most Irish remained preoccupied with the weather rather than the looming catastrophe. Even as the Gardener's Chronicle announced in mid-September that the potato murrain has unequivocally declared itself in Ireland, Dublin's Royal Horticultural Society celebrated abundant fruits and superior plant management. October 1845 seared itself into Irish memory as the moment when catastrophe became undeniable. As the late harvest began, fields across Ireland revealed the devastating extent of the blight. Men wept openly in Cork while pulling ruined potatoes from the ground. In Limerick, rain-soaked laborers abandoned fields like mourners. Desperate farmers sprinkled holy water on their potatoes and buried them with religious medallions, but nothing worked. James Prendergast of Kerry wrote to his American children that what had begun as a promising harvest had transformed into nationwide alarm, with newspapers teeming with alarming accounts of the disease spreading throughout the kingdom. The crop failure quickly ignited political turmoil across the United Kingdom. In England, it reignited the bitter 30-year war over the Corn Laws, with the Anti-Corn Law League demanding complete repeal of tariffs on foreign grain. Meanwhile, in Ireland, the crisis immediately fractured along sectarian lines. Protestants blamed Catholics, Catholics blamed Protestants, while Daniel O'Connell seized the opportunity to denounce the Anglo-Irish Union. On October 18th, Prime Minister Sir Robert Peel gathered three experts at his Yorkshire estate to address the potato crisis. Despite his reputation as Orange Peel for his former ardent support of Protestant Ireland, he now sought scientific solutions to the blight. When reports indicated healthy potatoes were spoiling in storage, Peel dispatched chemist Lyon Playfair to London to develop chemical treatments. As contradictory reports continued arriving from Ireland, Peel established a scientific commission to determine the real character and extent of the evil. As Ireland faced potential famine in November 1845, the British government established a relief commission with Sir Randolph Isham Routh, a respected commissariat logistics expert, as a key member. Public poor relief had come late to Ireland despite millions living in chronic destitution. Officials feared the expense and creating dependency, while Malthusian concerns about encouraging population growth also delayed action. By the 1830s, Irish poverty had become so severe it was draining the Irish people morally as well as physically. George Nicholls created a system of 130 workhouses with just 100,000 beds, funded by a poor rate tax on landholders. The workhouses were deliberately harsh, with intimidating architecture, humiliating admission procedures, and penal-like conditions, designed to make poverty so unbearable that the poor would embrace industry, self-reliance, and personal discipline. When the Relief Commission first met on November 20, they adopted Peel's scheme resembling previous relief efforts. Imported food would be sold at cost through local committees, and public works would provide wages. Though Peel relied primarily on private enterprise to supply food, he added one safeguard. He secretly arranged for Baring Bros to purchase 100,000 of American maize, enough to feed 1 million people for 40 days, to be used as a price control mechanism. Maize appealed to the government for multiple reasons beyond its affordability. Its short growing season and high yield made it ideal for modernizing Irish agriculture. The Victorians believed grains promoted character development, while lower foods like potatoes retarded it. The Edinburgh Review blamed potato dependency for the Irish having domestic habits of the lowest and degrading kind and living in a manner more akin to the South Seas than the great civilized communities. Most fundamentally, British officials believed the potato's ease of cultivation produced indolence and vice, while maize, which couldn't grow in Ireland's wet climate, would force peasants into wage labor and a money economy. Despite Thomas Ward's success in quietly purchasing American maize by January 1846, Peel's relief plan had critical flaws. It relied on Irish landlords who historically neglected their tenants during crises. The plan also required a commercial infrastructure, merchants who could import food internationally, and mills to process maize that barely existed outside Dublin, Cork, and Belfast. Rural Ireland lacked the network of village shops needed for distribution. While Ireland's crisis deepened, British politics descended into chaos. Lord John Russell's Edinburgh letter in November 1845 announced his conversion to free trade, a naked political ploy to ride the anti-corn law movement to power. Peel's cabinet deadlocked over the corn law issue as the Tory party split into protectionist and free trade wings. Protectionists like the Duke of Cambridge dismissed the famine as a hoax, insisting Irishmen can live on anything, while evangelical free traders claimed the potato blight was divine punishment for food tariffs. Throughout this political farce, the Irish crisis was largely forgotten in Britain, even as Ireland slid toward catastrophe. As winter deepened, food prices rose dramatically across Ireland. By January 1846, a stone of potatoes cost twice as much in Belfast as the previous year, with similar increases in Galway and Dublin areas. Desperate families sold their pigs, their only liquid asset, at plummeting prices to raise money for food. One woman calculated that feeding a laborer's family required 9 shillings weekly, while laborers earned only 6 shillings. The situation grew dire. Edward Shannon of Wexford worked until quite unfit, sold his cow to pay his debts, and was left with 6 children to feed. In Clare, a priest broke down describing his parish's suffering. As hunger spread, public attention turned to the massive food exports leaving Ireland. When Galway's wharves piled high with grain for export, threatening posters appeared. Merchants' stores will be broken up by the people if any further exportation of corn were attempted. Dublin Castle responded with military force. Dragoons occupied the streets, and the British warship Stromboli trained its guns on the harbor. Daniel O'Connell later informed Parliament that during 1845, Ireland had exported 200,000 head of livestock, 2 million quarters of grain, and hundreds of millions of pounds of flour to Britain despite the growing crisis. Despite local reports of starvation, a constabulary assessment claimed the situation wasn't as desperate as portrayed. The blight had claimed only a quarter to a third of the potato crop, not the 5/8 previously estimated. The government's relief plan established a 2-tier distribution system: commissariat depots for populated areas and Coast Guard sub-depots for remote western and midland regions. However, the system relied heavily on local relief committees funded by gentry donations, which were not forthcoming despite government matching grants. Meanwhile, William Hewitson, appointed to oversee the milling of American corn in Cork, encountered numerous technical difficulties. The complex milling process for maize, labor disputes, and logistical problems meant the Lee Mills facility could process only a fraction of the expected corn shipments by May when need would be greatest. With Treasury restricting domestic food purchases and commercial shippers reluctant to deliver to Ireland's dangerous western coast, Ruth was forced to rely on inadequate naval vessels for transport, lamenting that Providence had never intended Ireland to be a great nation. On a February morning in 1846, soldiers assembled in Mullingar's Square for the execution of Brian Serry, sentenced to death for an alleged attempt on Sir Francis Hopkins's life. As Father Savage transformed Serry into a nationalist martyr, the condemned man proclaimed his innocence before the noose dropped. His execution exemplified Dublin Castle's resolve against rising crime offenses, had nearly doubled during 1845's scarcity year. Violence was becoming increasingly brutal across rural Ireland. Officials feared want would mobilize disorder, while radical nationalists like John Mitchell proposed sabotaging railways to disrupt British troop movements. Disease was also rising, with medical officers reporting gastrointestinal disorders from consumption of blighted potatoes. By late February 1846, nearly 100 localities were approaching frank famine, though London officials remained skeptical, believing Irish peasants must have set aside provisions. In reality, most cabins had exhausted their 1845 crop, forcing desperate measures. Men sucking blood from living cows, families eating seaweed and grass, and peasants selling their clothing for food. Despite Treasury's February 20 instructions to form relief committees, donations trickled in painfully slowly. Even major areas like Limerick City received only 500, enough for just 50 tons of corn. County Clare's response was appalling, merely 417 for 300,000 mostly impoverished people. While Ireland faced starvation, nationalist politicians focused more on internal conflicts than famine solutions. The aging Daniel O'Connell and William Smith O'Brien of Young Ireland remained divided over fundamental approaches. O'Connell committed to non-violent constitutional struggle, while Smith O'Brien believed physical force could be justified. With the Irish political class distracted, predatory landlords seized the opportunity to move against small tenant farmers. Near the Roscommon-Galway border, Mrs. Gerard ordered the destruction of Ballinglass village to convert the land to more profitable pasture. Soldiers and bailiffs demolished 61 cottages, driving out 270 residents. By March 1846, hunger spread in a troubling checkerboard pattern across Ireland. Officials struggled to distinguish between newly destitute small farmers eligible for relief and the permanent pauper population. Edward Pine Coffin, a senior commissariat officer, returned from touring the West alarmed that some districts had reached final extremity, requiring the early release of Peel's American corn supplies. Charles Edward Trevelyan, Assistant Secretary of the British Treasury, significantly influenced Ireland's famine response. As a former East India clerk, he gained recognition for exposing corruption while frustrating superiors with his unwavering principles. William Bentinck noted that Trevelyan was almost always white, but gives the most confounded trouble when wrong. Trevelyan approached the Irish crisis with strong organizational abilities and firm ideological convictions. A Whig and laissez-faire advocate, he followed moralism, an evangelical belief opposing public aid as deterring self-improvement. He viewed the famine as divine intervention to teach the Irish a lesson. By March 1846, he controlled all major relief efforts, becoming the key decision-maker for Irish aid. The March 1846 Public Works Program was designed to provide income for food purchases. Though Peel initially favored infrastructure projects, the program defaulted to road construction through half-grant loans. This sparked overwhelming demand. A $50,000 budget faced nearly 1 million in applications, many seeking private gain rather than public benefit. By April, concerning patterns of emigration emerged. Officials worried not about numbers, but demographics. The departing were the bone and marrow of Ireland, prosperous young farmers taking substantial wealth abroad, signaling lost faith in Ireland's future. When government food depots opened on May 15th, they were severely unprepared. Despite Peel's warning that government couldn't feed 4 million people, desperate crowds gathered nationwide. Many were shocked to find the food wasn't free. The crisis was exemplified by a pregnant woman who walked miles to purchase meal while her husband lay starving at home. The public work system quickly showed flaws. It paid higher wages than agricultural work, 10-12 pence versus 4-6 pence, regardless of productivity, leading to minimal effort under poor supervision. The workforce exploded from 100,000 to 560,000 by August. Surgeon William Wilde described seeing ghosts of men traveling miles to break up good old road or commence unnecessary new ones. On June 25, 1846, as Ireland's crisis worsened, Parliament passed Corn Law Reform while Peel's government fell to a political coup. Lord John Russell, the incoming Prime Minister, departed quietly as one of history's most significant economic debates concluded. Early July 1846 brought brief optimism to Ireland as relief efforts seemed successful. The Irish praised Peel and the Queen, while economists celebrated the shift from potatoes to maize. However, by July 3rd, the first signs of potato disease reappeared. Reports of blight multiplied swiftly. The Western Star noted infected fields near Ballinasloe, followed by similar accounts across Ireland. By mid-July, the Cork Constitution confirmed withered leaves and damaged stalks. The third week brought darkness and relentless rain, allowing billions of fungal spores to spread through waterlogged fields. Surgeon William Wilde's early August observation was stark. The potato was gone. Within days, most of the 1846 crop was destroyed, including the crucial grand crop meant to sustain peasants through winter. The devastation created surreal scenes, from singing laborers in ruined fields to desperate harvesting of diseased tubers barely larger than plums. The August 15 deadline to close relief operations sparked crisis. Colonel Jones warned of hazardous half-finished roads, while Clare officials predicted mass unemployment. Archbishop MacHale called the closure an edict of general starvation. Trevelyan insisted on restructuring relief programs and assessing losses. Ireland's political unity crumbled as Young Ireland and Old Ireland factions split at Conciliation Hall. Young Ireland advocated a non-sectarian nationalism influenced by German Romanticism, while Old Ireland emphasized Catholic identity. The divide deepened when Thomas Meagher refused to renounce armed resistance. By September, the blight had ravaged Europe. Scotland's highlands lost 67% of potatoes, while continental losses ranged from 43% to 56%. Summer heat destroyed both potato and grain crops, causing food prices to surge. London wheat prices jumped 50%, while Irish potato prices rose from 10 to 15 pence per stone. Merchants like Russell in Limerick exploited the crisis, raising Indian meal prices dramatically. Colonel Jones doubted private dealers could supply the 1.5 million tons of corn needed to replace lost potatoes. Prime Minister Russell's August 17 address confirmed Ireland's worsening situation. His new relief plan shifted costs to Irish gentry through a mandatory labor rate tax, requiring full repayment of treasury loans with 3.5% interest. In autumn 1846, William Hewitson's assessment of southwest Ireland revealed dire conditions. In Killorglan, Kerry, he found ruined potato fields and families in mud-walled cabins who would exhaust their food by October's end. As winter approached, national anxiety intensified. London faced a severe supply crisis. Despite Routh's request for 16,000 tons of Indian corn, 8,000 by Christmas, and an additional 25,000 tons, only 3,100 tons were available by October. Global supplies were critically low, with New York holding just 50,000 bushels and Mediterranean markets nearly empty. Treasury ordered Western depots closed until after Christmas, leaving only commercial food at famine prices. The depot closures sparked fierce resistance. Sligo's Mr. Dobry warned that local traders, historically focused on exports, couldn't pivot to meet emergency demands. In Skibbereen, a 1,000-man march required military intervention to prevent riots. Trevelyan's relief plan failed for reasons Cork magistrate Nicholas Cummins identified. Ireland lacked Britain's modern economic infrastructure, rural shopkeepers, market competition, and adequate mills. Food had to be ground in England or Malta. By December, death became commonplace. Half of Skibbereen Workhouse's children admitted since October were dead or dying. Laborers collapsed returning from work, families perished by roadsides, and armed bands roamed the countryside. The economy collapsed, shops closed, manufacturing declined, and fields lay unplanted. Public works proved inadequate. Workers earned only 7 to 14 pence daily, half the promised wage, with frequent payment delays. The Cork Southern Reporter documented 3 Skibbereen laborers who starved after going unpaid for 4 weeks. The workhouse system collapsed under overwhelming demand. Occupancy doubled or tripled, North Dublin rising from 1,700 to 2,506, Cork City from 2,000 to 4,400. Conditions deteriorated horrifically. Nursing mothers couldn't feed their babies, sewers flooded, and supplies were inadequate. Routh urged Trevelyan to reopen government food depots immediately, warning violence could only be prevented by placing food at given points for sale. Trevelyan refused, claiming early opening would transfer the famine from Ireland to England. From the Eurasian steppe, a fierce autumn wind swept across Europe, bringing relentless snow to Ireland starting November 29. For weeks, it fell continuously, covering everything, the half-dug ditches, emigrant-packed ships, shoeless women searching for seaweed, the 5,000 paupers in Cork doorways, and the uncoffined dead. December brought mass death. Traditional funeral customs disappeared as coffins became scarce or unaffordable. Workhouses used reusable coffins with fall-away bottoms. The poor wrapped their dead in cardboard or newspapers. After already burying her husband and son, Bridie Sheehan came home to find her 16-year-old daughter dead. She washed and dressed the girl, then twisted hay into a rope to carry her daughter's body on her back to the chapel. Unable to dig a grave herself, neighbors Eamon Sheehy and Gregory Ash helped bury the girl beside her father and brother. Standing over their graves, Bridie said, "God bless all of you. Nobody else will join you now. There is only me left, and there will be nobody to look after me, to bury me here or anywhere else." Then she slowly made her way home alone. 8,000 tons of meal seemed substantial in September, but woefully inadequate by December, as peasants had consumed that much in just 2 months during a moderate scarcity the previous summer. With the 1846 American corn crop delayed by shipping shortages and international markets empty, Routh warned Trevelyan that the principal point is food. If we fail to provide it, all our other success will count for nothing. The government relief plan proved better at imposing restrictions than saving lives. Rebellion spread as local committees in Donegal, Cork, and Kerry ignored the market price rule, while workhouses defied regulations by providing outdoor relief and individual admissions. When the Poor Law Commissioner's threats and court orders failed, many workhouses went bankrupt. In January 1847, fate opened her book in good earnest, and the full tide of death flowed on as pestilence engulfed Ireland. Irish medical men had anticipated this, knowing from historical experience that blight typically produced major epidemics. Despite early warning signs, officials initially downplayed the threat, allowing the Temporary Fever Act to expire in August 1846. By November, however, fever cases were rising sharply across the country, and by midwinter, epidemic fever was widespread throughout Ireland. Ireland had experienced devastating fever epidemics following crop failures before. The 1740-1741 epidemic killed between 250,000 and 400,000 people in a nation of less than 2.5 million. Another severe epidemic occurred between 1816-1819 when an estimated 1.5 million people were infected and 65,000 died. Irish physicians eventually determined the epidemic was driven by two different illnesses, typhus and relapsing fever. The lowly louse proved to be the critical vector in the epidemic. Exquisitely adapted to human hosts, with strong legs, claws, powerful mouthparts to pierce skin and suck blood, and glutinous saliva to attach eggs to hair, lice were highly vulnerable to Rickettsia, the genus containing typhus pathogens. The chaos of mass death, flight, and social breakdown had shattered the protective isolation that normally shielded rural Irish communities from epidemics. Despite harsh winter conditions, the roads teemed with lice-bearing travelers. Orphans, paupers, laborers, evicted farmers, and emigrants, many with no destination beyond escape. The traditional hospitality code that prevented turning away strangers ensured disease spread rapidly. The pestilence decimated caregivers. In Connemara, two of three physicians died. Between Clifton and Galway City, four doctors perished. In County Cavan, seven. Of 473 government medical officers assigned to fever duty, one in 13 died. Catholic priests suffered high mortality, and Church of Ireland vicars significant losses, including Dr. Trail, who had pioneered soup kitchens. Though pestilence killed perhaps 10 famine victims for every one who starved, the starving peasant remained the famine's signature image. Newspaper artists like James Mahoney of the Illustrated London News depicted mid-stage starvation. Protruding bones, hollowed faces, but self-censored the most hideous later stages, inflamed eyelids, cavernous mouth lines, tumor-sized thyroid glands, white fungus covering tongues, blistering mouth sores, parchment skin, decaying teeth, pus-oozing gums, and faces covered in silky hair. By early March 1847, the crisis was deepening despite American corn arriving in bulk. Nicholas Cummins wrote to Trevelyan that distress and misery spread daily wider, while mortality in western districts continued unabated. When M.P. Smith O'Brien claimed 240,000 had already died from starvation, Irish Chief Secretary Labouchet denied the figure, but admitted the government had no official count, a fact that outraged Lord George Bentinck. The public works program had failed, with average daily wages falling to 7.5p, leaving laborers deeply indebted to gumbeam men. In response, the Russell government planned a nationwide network of 2,000 soup kitchens to provide free food while closing the public works program so laborers could return to plant crops. General John Burgoyne, appointed to head the soup kitchen operation, prioritized creating an orderly, fraud-proof system over immediate relief. His operation at College Green produced mountains of paperwork, 14 tons of documents, including millions of food cards, while people continued to starve. Every detail was scrutinized: who qualified for relief, color coding of index cards, soup line procedures, and especially what kind of soup to serve. Alexis Soyer, the celebrated French chef of London's Reform Club, proposed a soup for the poor that would cost only 34p per quart, half the price of average soup kitchen fare. Despite criticism that his soup number one was nutritionally inadequate, the cost-conscious British government invited him to Dublin to establish a model kitchen. Soyer designed an elaborate scientific facility at the Royal Barracks with precise dining protocols, zigzag entrances for crowd control, timed bells for seating and eating, and chained soup spoons. With public works rolls reaching 708,000 and monthly costs of 944,000, the government ordered immediate reductions. On March 20th, 146,000 laborers were dismissed, affecting up to 700,000 people, including families, despite soup kitchens not being ready to replace this support. the first 100 kitchens wouldn't open until March 26th. Dismissed workers walked off the works, rending the air most terrifically with cries and shrieks and almost death groans. On March 24th, the United Kingdom observed a national day of fast and humiliation for Ireland. While press claimed universal participation, reality was mixed. Many Londoners skipped church entirely, heading to Greenwich for picnics and leisure. Critics like Miso Humbug questioned ministers' authority to direct the vengeance of omnipotence, while John Stuart Mill called blaming Providence nonsensical. The Poor Law Extension Act would transfer all Irish relief costs to Irish ratepayers, potentially raising property taxes from £400,000 to £1,800,000. Despite warnings from 64 Irish peers and 43 MPs that this would cause social disorder, Russell pushed forward. On March 29th, William Gregory's amendment passed by 117-7, denying relief to small farmers unless they surrendered all but a quarter acre of land. This transformed the Poor Law into an instrument of social engineering, crushing the small farmer class. Within 6 years, farms between 1 and 5 acres would decline by 52%. By early May 1847, spring remained backward with cold air and gloomy atmosphere. Dublin papers warned the 1847 crops appeared to be failing. Wheat looked bad, oats were slow to emerge, and fewer potatoes had been planted than anticipated. This news galvanized the wavering and fearful to flee Ireland. While 116,000 had emigrated in 1846 in an orderly fashion, by spring 1847, people were fleeing recklessly. 215,000 sailed to North America and 150,000 to Britain. The emigrant ships now carried not just the middle classes, but the ancient Gaelic-speaking peasantry who had never ventured far from home. Overnight, generational bonds to the land shattered as people became barefoot pilgrims heading to ports, sustained only by hatred for their circumstances. The exodus was so desperate that parents abandoned children to poorhouses. Landlords subsidized tenant departures to reduce poor rates, and workhouses provided fare money to inmates. Those without subsidies auctioned possessions or solicited money from relatives abroad. "I cannot hold on long," wrote one Carey woman to her children in Boston. "For the honor of our Lord Jesus Christ and His blessed mother, hurry and take us out of this," wrote another parent. Entire townlands emptied. Some Galway villages lost a third of their population, while the Catholic population in parts of Roscommon shrank by 10-17% in months. For two-thirds of Irish emigrants, the journey west began paradoxically with a voyage east across the Irish Sea to Liverpool. The 5-shilling deck tickets all peasants could afford bought no food, water, shelter, or sanitation facilities. Crew members exploited passengers by selling water for 6 pence and brief refuge in the warm engine room for 1 shilling. The unpredictable Irish Sea made crossings treacherous. Journalist Stuart Redmond described sailing through 30-foot waves, dodging hurtling bodies and cargo crates as ships pitched violently. Liverpool, the bully of the litter of English port cities, had grown wealthy on slavery, sugar, and tobacco before pivoting to emigrant transportation after Britain abolished slavery in 1807. For Irish peasants, Liverpool's wonders were beyond imagining. Vast parliament of masts, china walls of masonry at the docks, and polyglot streets filled with Chinese sailors, Sikhs in colorful turbans, Scottish merchants, West Indian beggars, American cotton merchants, prostitutes, and orderly German immigrants also fleeing crop failures. Nearly 300,000 Irish emigrants poured into Liverpool in 1847, with almost half staying due to poverty. The city became both burial ground and relief station for Ireland's dead weight, a price paid for Liverpool's ruthless manipulation of Irish agricultural prices. Liverpool's poor relief expenditures on Irish paupers skyrocketed 889% between 1845-1847, while municipal pleas for government assistance went ignored. For Irish emigrants, Liverpool represented a brutal first encounter with modernity. Peasant culture had afforded even the poorest a sense of dignity. Every townland had its wise men, storytellers, and poets. But in Liverpool, the emigrant suddenly found himself an object of horror and contempt. Pedestrians avoided him, shopkeepers bolted doors, and street urchins mocked his appearance and accent. This Liverpool mirror, as historian Robert Scully called it, forced a peasant to see himself through modern eyes. No longer a respected member of a traditional community, but Punch's aboriginal Irishman, illiterate, savage. On August 2, 1847, thousands gathered at St. Mary's Cathedral in Dublin for Daniel O'Connell's funeral after the 72-year-old liberator's death in Genoa. His funeral procession had received honors across Europe before reaching Dublin Harbor. That summer brought mixed omens. While early potato blight fears in Cork proved unfounded, by August, mourners at O'Connell's funeral noted flourishing potato fields. The hot, dry weather had defeated both the blight and fever, as Lord Clarendon, the new viceroy, celebrated. General Burgoyne's soup kitchens had finally succeeded by simply feeding people rather than attempting moral reform. At their peak, 2,000 kitchens fed 3 million daily. But their planned August 15 closure raised concerns, despite healthy crops being just a quarter of normal size and with public works ending, how would people afford imported food? The new poor law, meant to replace public works, faced critical challenges. Quaker James Hack Tuke's assessment found the wealthy regions unwilling to hire more workers, while the poorer West lacked resources amid rising evictions. London pushed forward partly due to recession fears, as Ireland's food imports had triggered a financial crisis under the gold standard. The government also hoped poor relief would discourage Irish migration to Britain, where immigrants were increasingly visible in public spaces. The human toll was stark. When 12-year-old Michael Dugnan, orphaned by fever, was deported from Rochdale to Ireland, he died aboard the overcrowded Duchess of Kent despite crew efforts to save him. While such individual tragedies still moved some Britons, public sentiment had hardened. Many now viewed the famine as divine providence, transforming evil into good. The devastation continued into the 1850s. The Gregory Clause drove eviction rates up 1,000% between 1847 to 1851, overwhelming the poor law system. 1 million died and 2 million fled, reducing Ireland's population by a third. England's relief policies, though not genocidally intended, were parsimonious, short-sighted, grotesquely twisted by religion and ideology, causing countless preventable deaths and generations of Irish bitterness toward England.